Alan Kohler here with today's CEO, and it's Kevin Moriarty, the CEO of 1414 Degrees, or 1414 Degrees, which is a company that's been around a few years and listed just last month in September on the stock exchange, having raised $16.3 million at 35 cents. And the shares promptly sank a bit like a stone, but that's life, I guess. They're currently at 30 cents, so still, you know, not too far off the list price, 30 cents, but they did get down to about 23 at one point after the float. What they do is they have a system for storing energy through molten silicon, which has a melting point of 1,414 degrees. That's the name of the company. And they're basically an energy storage operation. They store both heat and electricity, effectively. But the interesting thing about them, I think, is that they are capable, says Kevin Moriarty, of turning intermittent solar and wind power into baseload power, because it's basically very cheap storage, very large scale, and they can essentially end the intermittency of solar and wind. So, look, it's a really interesting prospect. They are a fair way off making money, however, like a couple of years, I guess, and possibly even longer till they start selling big, large-scale grid-type storage systems. So it's one of those businesses that requires patience. It's a long-term play, no doubt about it. It's not short-term. It is possible, of course, that in the short term, institutions will have a look at it and start to bid the price up. So you could see some action before that they start making money in a couple of years' time, but you know, you can't really count on that. At the moment, they're 90% mum and dad investors, because the float was essentially a crowdfunding exercise. They basically converted their Twitter and Facebook followers into small investors, of which they've got quite a lot now. So, look, they had a bit of a following. I think people have been getting out. Those who invested early have been taking a profit and getting out. So it might be a good time to buy. But, look, it's, as I say, a long-term investment. Energy storage turns solar and wind into baseload power. And probably worth a listen to this interview of Kevin Moriarty, CEO of 1414 Degrees. Kevin, since we last spoke, you became a listed company. What sort of adventure was that?
Well, it's quite a journey, and but we were largely driven by the ever-increasing numbers of people who were connecting with us on, you know, social media, through our website, email. And so we over 2 years, we accumulated over 9,000, shall we call them, followers. And by and large, these are what I call mums and dads. And quite a few, a lot of them were saying, why can't we get involved? Why can't we invest in this company? And of course, they're not sophisticated investors. And so we raised about $15 million from sophisticated investors over the first year. And then we turned our attention to letting these thousands of non-sophisticated, they call them, investors in. So I was just saying to our people that, you know, really it's been a form of crowdfunding, and we've listed in order to allow these people to invest. And just to give you a sense of it, even since listing a month ago, we've taken on over 1,000 new shareholders. So we now have over 3,000.
So can I just go through? So you raised $15 million during the first 2 years from sophisticated investors. What was the company's valuation for that $15 million? Were there several of them? Were there several raisings and several
valuations? Yes, there were series so which began at 10 cents.
Could you take us through the valuations that occurred over those 2 years?
Yes, I'd have to... I haven't got a cheat sheet in front of me where I'd know the numbers of shares, but the valuation began...
the pre-money valuation for, you know, just I just want to get a sense of how your valuation has gone over those 2 years.
Okay. Initially, it was around $8 million. Originally around $2 million when I got involved. Then we did successive raisings at 10, 15, 20, 24, and 28 cents. And took on, this was, and this was subscribed to worldwide. So the valuation at the finish was around, at the time of listing, was between about $60 million. And the valuations would have gone from 2 to 10 to about 17 and then about 20, but about $25 million pre.
And the valuation in the float, you're saying the valuation in the float was $60 million, are you?
Yes, yes, with the issue, with the issue of the raising of $16 million, yes.
Because I think you...
No, I can
you
supply you with exact figures.
Yeah, that's okay. No, I think you were hoping for 40 or 50 million in the float, but you only got 16.
Well, we're 30 million, yeah. But the how that came about is we surveyed our 9,000 people, you know, followers, and several thousand of those responded and said, yes, we'll subscribe to the float. So it doesn't take a genius to work out that you can potentially raise a lot. And you've got to understand the context. We were saying that we wanted to build something that would make a difference at grid scale to the energy storage market, and we're still doing that. But in order to finance that fully, we needed to raise that sort of money. And so that's what we went for. But we didn't know really how much people were going to subscribe. We didn't have any way of really assessing it until we listed, you know, until we actually did the prospectus. So given that this is a new technology and we're dealing with not institutions and people that you can sort of mark up for millions of dollars a piece, so we didn't have any way to price it. And so effectively our IPO priced us. But we raised, something like a bit more than half the target, initial target anyway. So we judged it a success, and now building towards, you know, the next phases, which will be to build these grid scale devices.
Did you get a few people who said they'd invest, but when it came time to write a check, they squibbed it? Is that what
exactly happened? Yes, yes.
Do you think they were put off by the $2,100 minimum?
Some of them were. Some of them complained and said, could you make it less? And what? So I can tell you that a lot of these 1,000 people that have come on since the float are buying in quite small lots. You know, you're taking on people that are buying 2,000 shares and, you know, certainly less than $10,000. So we... You know, it shows you that our support base is very wide based, and we're not. There's nobody in the company that's a big risk. Put it that way.
So can before we just get on to the contracts you're doing and the business itself, I just wanted to just finally just get a sense of your cash position now, because when you looking at your annual report for June 30. You're just about out of cash. You know, you're down to less than $1 million, and you're burning a hell of a lot of money. I presume you still are. You got that $16.3 million in. So, what's your position now? We're middle of October.
Well, we're not.
How much cash have you got?
We've got over $15 million. The cash burn, remember the grants from the government have been paying half the development of the gas tests.
Yep.
The most of the expenditure was finished by the time that report came out. In other words, we had built and were starting to test the test industry, the test end machine we're currently commissioning down at our plant. And so that's under commissioning. So there's only just running costs at the moment. The gas test is all the components were paid for and being assembled, and that's that's being assembled, starting assembly next month down at the Glenelg wastewater plant. So we funded the first two devices to the point of being able to test them. So the IPO was not primarily directed at those. It was directed at the next generation of devices, one for, you know, the packaging plant and the duck factory and so on in the east. And we're still doing feasibility on those. So there's not a big cash burn.
So tell us about the ones you've got going. There's a pilot one, I think, with SA Water Company. Is that right?
Yes, SA Water approached us saying they wanted a solution to allow them to time shift the energy generated from their biogas production, you know, from all the digesting poo. And they said we're currently using these reciprocating engines. They're like huge diesel engines to generate power, but they had no way of time shifting it. And they use the heat from it to displace gas. They, you know, is used in heating the big vats of waste. They needed that more in the mornings than the evenings, which is when the bugs were working hardest. So they said, "Can you come up with a version of your device that burns biogas to provide the heat, and then so we can generate heat and power when we need it." So we developed that. The state government's funded half of that, and that will be starting commissioning in the next couple of months. So that's going to be a big plus for us, because there's huge interest worldwide in the biogas burning. I mean, everything from cow, you know, dairy farms, which produce huge amounts in a concentrated form, through to major water utilities worldwide, are interested in this sort of technology, especially as it allows, you know, the time shifting. The other one is the 10 megawatt hour electrically charged device, which is our basic, original model, and that's in commissioning at the moment. That's going well. We'll have an update for the market shortly, and that's designed to go into an Austcore packaging factory on the East Coast for, on-site commercial testing. But we're certainly, you know, we're proving it works now, and we'll come out with a certification on that shortly.
And so just run us through the business model. With these things, do you just sell the unit to them and off they go, or do you get an ongoing revenue?
Both. We're looking at both models. Probably the gas charging units will be, because they're being sold to utilities and so on, will largely, they've got ready access to capital, and they're looking at things like the justification for investing that is they're going to be, ours will be cheaper to run than their current reciprocating type engines, or they're currently flaring gas, in which case it's simply got no value, but they want to reduce their emissions. So there's a number of drivers. But we are looking at a model, because these are relatively cheap to make, our machines, that we would set up effectively a service model whereby we would provide this service. So we'll take your gas, you provide it, and we will share in the sales of energy and heat to, you know, sales of energy to industry or the waste treatment plant. So there's at least two models there. As far as the smaller units, the 10 megawatt hour units I described that we're just commissioning now, these, once they're proven in the commercial environment, will attract infrastructure, bank backing. Currently, for example, the model that Austcore and others are working on, they put in solar, and the storage, and these packages are funded by one of four banks, Macquarie, Westpac, for example, ANZ. These uh, the CEFC, the what's CEFC stand for? You know, it's the federal government's fund for Clean Energy Finance Corporation. That's it.
There you go. That's it. Well done. I was struggling as well.
They've got several billion dollars that they are using to help finance the rollout of renewable energy. So they provide larger funding packages to the banks, like say ANZ will take on a $200 million. The bank then repackages them in, you know, much smaller packages of $1-5 million, which and effectively provides a lease buy arrangement for people that want to put in. Currently, it's mainly solar energy, and what our devices will allow them to do is to time shift the solar production. Because what's happening is Auscor fire up their boilers at 3 a.m. in the morning, so they're hot to start a production run at 6 with the new shift. And solar's no use at all at that hour. so they want to charge them up through the day and then turn them on and provide primarily heat and some power. So when you come to a model, it's driven ultimately by not just the fact that renewable solar PV is getting so cheap now, you know, the cost of production from it is very, very small, the capital as well. They want to be able to say they've got like green packaging or at least low emissions packaging, which for the packaging industry would be a big thing. So there's not just the shall we say the energy in, energy out costs. There's the add-on values of being able to tick the box on emissions, and you know, later if there's carbon pricing in this country and so on of any note, which I think is likely to happen, the rate things seem to be changing politically, then obviously these things will qualify. You know, tick the box on your you know, meeting your emissions targets, and have a dollar value attached.
Just to summarise what you're saying there, are you saying that that your thermal energy storage devices, in a sense, become part of the financing package for these businesses to have solar?
Correct. Infrastructure, yes. So, it's the necessary infrastructure.
So you become part of the funding in a way, because you enable them to time shift the power to the time when they use it in the middle of the night.
Well, the more important thing is happening, you realise, is we're displacing gas, and gas can be pretty expensive in Australia at the moment. So what we're effectively doing is replacing gas with electricity. and I don't think people have quite realised that, but the rise of cheap solar, you know, a few years ago, you would have been thought insane if you thought that solar was going to displace gas. But the ever decreasing cost of solar panels has made it actually quite feasible now.
So the next question is: are you saying that your devices are cheaper than lithium batteries?
Well, lithium batteries don't cut it for this. I mean, lithium batteries have their place. You know, if you just want power, and you want to, and you don't mind replacing them, you know, if you don't cycle too often, because otherwise they need replacing quite quickly. But you know, lithium battery doesn't cut it for industry. They want primarily heat, at least 2/3 of their requirements for heat, usually up to 90%. So batteries, the power is a relatively small part. In fact, some industries say to us, forget the power, we'll get that off the grid, and because most of our energy needs are in heat.
Oh, I see. So your devices are actually not just generating power; they're providing heat for these factories.
Correct. And in fact, the industries have come to us. They've driven this. So we initially we thought rather naively, I suppose, that we would be providing, you know, competing with batteries. But in reality, batteries can't do what we do, and we do what, you know, the majority of the world's energy spectrum needs, which is we provide heat and power. So you know, we're not, there'll be a place for batteries where people just want some household backup, but we're going for scale, Alan, and you know, everything from our preference is 10 megawatts, 10 megawatt hours up. And in the end result of what we're trying to do will be to provide versatile storage anywhere, you know, throughout the grid at a relatively low cost, which means that people actually won't think they need batteries anymore, because if you've got reliable power, which we don't have at the moment here in South Australia for sure, you know, but why would people spend on these, you know, these solar battery sort of complexes that have been put on houses? I don't mind, you know, the solar can be fed back into the grid. The problem is the grid's not able to absorb and time shift it at the moment. So,
what South Australia did was install a 100 megawatt lithium battery from Tesla.
Yeah, but could you have done that?
Yeah, no, but could you have done that cheaper?
We just have to have a bigger device. But the reality is, the big battery is very good for what it does, which is providing occasional bursts of power on the grid. And I think the batteries will always have a place there. But it was very expensive, but it provides a service. But primarily it's providing a frequency control, and it's used occasionally when the frequency starts varying because, you know, something trips out or there's an outage on a power transmission line and things like that. Or a big generator in one of the big generators has to be taken offline or falls offline quickly. Look, a battery's ideal for that. We can provide a similar thing, but you'd have to say a battery was the thing of choice. But we're talking our minimum grid scale to be 200 megawatt hours, so twice the size of that. Up to, and most the sort of devices we envisage will be in the gigawatt hour range, so we'll be up there with the sort of pumped hydros and even the Snowy scheme in terms of providing huge amounts of storage and power, but at a much lower cost and distributed potentially through the grid. So it's where the users need it, not necessarily sitting in some mountains somewhere.
Does your energy storage for electricity, does that mean that you create steam which drives a turbine? Does that mean then that it's slower than both a battery or a pumped hydro? That, you know, slower to generate the electricity, you can't do it instantly?
That's correct if you're feeding into a turbine, but you'd say the same with pumped hydro. But if your turbine's spinning, you've got a lot of spinning inertia. I mean, in the design, ours would be designed to be providing effectively baseload power, so they are sitting there with a lot of inertia. If you've got a lot of inertia, spinning inertia on your grid, you don't need the big batteries. They're only needed because we've got a relatively unstable grid with the increasing renewables and not enough, you know, big power stations anymore, particularly, you know, in at the end of the grid like South Australia.
So are you saying, if I can interrupt there, are you saying that your device effectively turns solar and wind into baseload power?
Correct.
Right.
And that's the aim. That's the aim at the big scale, leave aside the industry. But that's right. We're taking the intermittency out of it, and it needs to be done at a low cost. The problem with, you know, a lot of the other solutions, and they all have a place. If you've got a, you know, you've got some dams up in the mountains, well, you can use them. But, you know, they're not located where the users are. And, you know, and it's going to be very low cost. So it'll be, you know, if we're going to have low cost electricity, and gas, frankly, we need to come up with low-cost storage, you know, with renewables. We need a low-cost storage. It's as simple as that, and that's where we're positioning our device. We're not saying there's not a place for batteries. There is, but we'd like to make batteries an optional extra rather than a, a sort of necessary part of the infrastructure.
Now, can you give us a sense of your price then? I mean, that, firstly, at the 10 megawatt and the 100 and 200, I mean, if you manage to sell a 10 megawatt hour device to, say, Auscore for its factory, what will you charge them?
Well, that's sort of commercial in confidence, of course, but you can see what the, from our prospectus, I can talk about it because we've actually costed the first installation there, which is at about $3 million for something that delivers more than 10 megawatt hours. So, that gives you an idea. But we think the production cost eventually of our technology will be more like around the $70 per $70,000 per megawatt. Right. But that's our aim, and that's the cost of the storage, not the turbines and so on. As I say, Auscore and that, they want steam. They're not really interested in the power. So we can produce that constantly, day in, day out, for decades, without any degradation and very high efficiency. So it's it's a no-brainer, and so you just don't talk about batteries in that situation. They just can't do it, and you wouldn't use them.
Yeah. What a 100 megawatt thing's going to cost $7 million.
Well, in terms of the storage part, that's where we're aiming to go in the production cost. At the moment, we're several times that because we're only in the first build stage. But that's the sort of numbers. Yes, it's very cheap.
So what sort of margin would you get there? Crikey,
We're not selling it for that. I'm telling you what we think we can build them for.
Oh, I see.
And then, and then the question is, that's what we're aiming for. And it's because we think we can do that is why we think there's a very good business case for this, just about everywhere, because we should be able to then build almost all of our devices will go in on a project basis. In other words, because we're doing lots of valuations from people that have come to us, everybody ranging from waste, waste management dumps where they've got methane coming off through to the, wastewater industry like SA Water, all the way through to packaging industry. These people are all coming to us, and they're telling us their needs. In every case, it's different. So, you have to do it on a case-by-case basis, on a project basis. And we're working with engineering companies to, provide tailor-made solutions. But the underlying key is going to be that the basic cost per megawatt hour of storage is going to be low, so we can offer very low-cost solutions for them that everybody wins from.
You presented at a show in the US, I think, a month ago.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Okay, we were asked to and given a free slot at what they call the Electrification Conference, which is run by a body called EPRI, who, now you're going to ask me what that means. It's the power. It's all the big power utilities in the US. They have a research arm. And EPRI, we got a director resident in the US, and he's connected with the energy industry there, and so he was approached by a utility. They were talking to him, and they said, "Look, you guys, we've been following you guys. You guys really should get in this." And they're into this conference and tell people what you're doing. So they arranged for us to have a free booth, and we were approached by utilities across the US and various other, energy type oriented companies. What we found was that the natural gas US has huge amounts of gas. In fact, has so much the pipelines. There's not enough pipeline capacity. But the trouble is the pipelines they have that go particularly to the colder parts of the US. It's very hard for them to increase capacity on those for a whole lot, you know, just simply getting the infrastructure in and getting approvals and all this. So there are times with the increasing utilization of electricity that the big generators, you know, gas generators and industries that are all using gas, the same people that are coming to us in Australia that are burning gas at the moment are saying, well, we can't get enough gas. There's times when we simply can't power our turbines or get a contract on the gas. So they are very interested. So for instance, the New York governor's decreed that there should be 1,500 megawatts of power available from stored energy by, I think it's 2030. So they are driven by similar things to here, but they're actually not as advanced as Australia in many aspects of the of understanding the need for storage. So that's why it's been driven at, you know, at higher level. But they certainly are very interested in displacing gas and with electricity, and that's where our device comes in, because you can put in renewable energy and have a way of storing it.
So I'm going to have to finish in a minute, but just to finalize, just to, as a final question, when do you think you're going to start making money?
We think the gas test is going to be the first cab off the rank for us, and it's pretty much a no-brainer given the fact that we're using flared gas and competing with engines that are very expensive to maintain and build. So we're expecting that the next financial year we should get our first orders for those devices. So I'd say in the next financial year, 19-20, we're expecting to make our first sales.
Right.
And that should bring the institutions into the register then.
Yep. Good to talk to you, Kevin. Thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure, Alan.
That was Kevin Moriarty, the CEO of 14 Degrees.